Welcome to Trending in Education. Very excited today to have a good friend of the show back. Roar Saxberg is back for a return engagement. We got a lot of very positive feedback about what learning science insights are useful and relevant to parents. Really enjoyed it. Learned a lot. I'm still serving and returning and appreciate Roar on that engagement. But now we have Roar back. We're going to talk about some new interesting things. But Roar, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we had fun last time. And there are so many aspects of our lives as people that are actually connected to our ability to learn and become better at things. And we often forget that, especially in a long life where you feel like school was a long time ago. And we kind of forget, that's not the only place where learning really matters. And so it's fun to be able to talk more about this. And I'm glad to join you again, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked more about parents and thinking about kids and that kind of development. Now, this conversation is going to be more, to your point, about the rest of what happens. Once you're no longer a kid, you're still learning. You're still either formally or increasingly through informal learning or, you know, experiential learning on the job. You're acquiring skills, you're developing capabilities, you're developing expertise is something we're going to talk about as part of this conversation as well. But I think you wanted to ground some of the conversation in the actual learning science, the research that is out there, some of the fundamentals of cognitive science, cognitive psychology, and learning theory. And I think you wanted to begin with some talk of perhaps 10,000 hours deliberate practice. That stuff is certainly out there in the zeitgeist.
Yeah. And I thought maybe even start by, you know, why does this matter at all? You know, and then come down to, okay, how does the machinery actually work if this is important, right? Mm-hmm. Why does this matter at all? Well, so it's sort of interesting. If you go back to the Middle Ages, which I know you and I love to do, right?
Right. We hop in the DeLorean and go.
Back we go, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It used to be, you know, that if you became an expert in your late teenage years or early 20s or something, your expertise would carry you through your life. And in fact, your grandchildren, if you were a stonemason working on Notre Dame, would welcome being handed your tools as you were putting them down, right? Because they would be just as good for your grandchildren as they were for you, right? Mm-hmm. But if you fast forward to today, or even, you know, within the last 20 years, we are in a very different world of work where the pace at which good practice at work changes is accelerating so that, I mean, it used to be you would train to be an X in your late teens. You would then practice as an X through the next few decades. Then you would retire and you'd be an XX. Sorry about that, but you'd be an XX.
That's good. Yeah.
And you'd be proud, right?
Yeah.
And now, no, this is not the way it's going to work. And we actually do have a lot of people who feel like that original bargain has been broken. Right? That, hey, I got to be good at running machine tools in my 20s. And, you know, why can't we go back to that? Why can't we go back to mining the way we used to do it? Why can't we go back to X the way we used to do it, right? And the economics of all this, it's not going to allow that. That is just simply working better for the economics to have these changes happen. And now the half-life is way less than a person's career. So this is why the question of, oh, how do we change expertise is no longer a one-time issue for people's lives. It's no longer, oh, well, when I'm young, that's when I learn, right?
Right,
and then,
right.
Then it doesn't happen anymore. So let's go talk a bit about the machinery here, how learning seems to work. The first piece of good news that came out in all this work on brain sciences in the 70s and 80s, and even a little before, is that brains change almost all the way through life.
Right.
There was a belief a long time ago that, oh, it's all over once you get past your mid-20s. If you haven't learned it by then, it's downhill from there.
Right.
In fact, no, the learning machinery, the myelination machinery, how the neurons change and reconnect, that's all there. There may be some changes in rate or whatever, but it is all there waiting to happen.
The thing I've heard, I don't know if this should be debunked or if it's relevant in any way, is the difference between fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence, where the trope, at least that's out there, is as you get older, you have more crystallized intelligence where it's a little more rigid and it's sort of mapped to, it makes sense. It's kind of mapped to your mental models and whatever schema you have. And changing those models and being more fluid is something that gets harder as you age.
Yeah, it's probably fair. That's a whole other podcast episode around.
Good, good. Yeah, I gotta bring you back. Always leave them wanting more. You know,
but that basic insight that says, "Hey, wait a minute. You know, we can benefit," and that we're going to talk about this in a little bit about we can benefit from having more and more things stuck into our heads in what's called long-term memory. So let's dive in for a moment into, you know, how expertise really works and what cognitive scientists have found about, you know, what is expertise? How do you acquire it? And then connect that to, okay, so what happens over time in careers? Mm-hmm. So what cognitive scientists have been studying how expertise works really since the 1960s and before. And one of the mistakes they originally made was to think, well, we just have experts sit down and they will describe their expertise. How hard can this be, right? Mm. There were actually some famous experiments in the 60s. This was the early artificial intelligence work where, unlike current artificial intelligence, which is more statistical, complicated stuff, the early artificial intelligence was literally, how do we replicate how humans make decisions by having computers do the same thing?
I was just reading about this. This is the symbolic AI versus subsymbolic, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And so the thinking was, well, this isn't that hard. We just sit down an infectious disease specialist and he will describe or she will describe how he or she works. We will write that all down. We'll stuff it into a, you know, a computer system and we'll have infectious disease expertise available worldwide. Our job there will be done almost by lunchtime.
Right.
What they discovered is when they began interviewing these, in this one case I'm thinking of, I think the computer software program was called Mycin, M-Y-C-I-N, that in fact, it didn't make sense what the experts were saying that they were making decisions on. When you looked at it, it wasn't complete. Mm. So the cognitive scientists then began looking in more depth and more detail. And what they discovered, which is really important, is that something like 70% or more of what a top performer decides and does is no longer consciously accessible to them. Mm-hmm. Their brain is doing this thing that it was trained to do. Mm-hmm. It's now doing it in a way that is not the verbal way that it was learned by that brain.
Right.
So what began to become clear is that there is this difference between what you might call working memory, which is where sensory stuff comes for its first stop. It's where your conscious voice lives. Mm-hmm. So you know, when you're having an internal monologue about what's happening and so forth, that's all happening in working memory. And then working memory is backed up by things that are in long-term memory. So long-term memory is completely different than working memory. That long-term memory lasts a long time. Working memory stuff disappears very quickly. Mm-hmm. Long-term memory also takes a bunch of training, but once it gets good, it's really fast.
Yeah.
It can do a lot of things in parallel, whereas working memory is slow and really can't do many things at once. It has to kind of focus to do one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. And then long-term memory also, if it's been trained well, it's very accurate. It keeps repeating good things within kind of rigid bounds. And so if long-term memory is confronted with something brand new that it's never seen before, it knows to basically dump to working memory and say, yo, working memory, you got to do stuff.
Yeah.
So the example I often use, because this all seems very strange, and you know, what is nonverbal access to knowledge? Does that even have meaning? Right? Philosophers a long time ago used to think, if you can't say it, you don't know it.
Right.
I mean, there was a whole school of philosophy that said knowledge is directly tied to words and language. Mm-hmm. This cognitive science really pushes on that. And so the example I like to use is driving.
Right.
And so, you know, I tried this example once in Singapore and it didn't work because there aren't that many drivers, you know, fluent drivers there. But for many parts of the world, you know, driving is a common expert activity that people learn how to do really well. And so the example I like to give is you set out for place A and then you start thinking about life and the universe and work and family.
Yeah.
You look up and you've gotten to place B instead.
Right.
I was like, oh, shoot. I usually end up at a Starbucks. I'm always under caffeinated, right? So it's like, I did it again. I got to my local Starbucks. What am I doing? And usually we just laugh at ourselves. We back up and we get going to where
we're going. Well, you also say, I mean, I'm at Starbucks. I might as well pick up a cup of coffee. I mean, you don't want to waste the trip.
Exactly. Yeah. But what we don't do is ask ourselves, wait, who drove me to place B?
Right.
Who was in charge of a ton of metal
moving
10, 20, 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
5, 10, 20 minutes.
Right.
Because that's the thing about long-term memory and what can be done by expert processes there. It's not just one shot instant. It's like right. you can run a car and driving and right. the decision-making and all this. It happened to be headed towards the wrong target. But I was then able to think about my vacation or my life yeah. or my work mm-hmm. while this long-term memory expertise was able to make it work. And so
it does remind me of Daniel Kahneman and Thinking Fast and Slow.
Exactly, exactly. And so a key thing here is that if it's been trained correctly, like good driving usually has been, then you can kind of rely on it. You don't have to panic over this.
Yeah, I mean, I drive in Brooklyn, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You have to learn to drive dangerously, which is a whole nother story.
Yeah, or when I was in school in Boston, man, what they learned was not necessarily good for the species. But so what you have there then is this notion of, look, you can get a lot of complicated information, pattern matching, even processes embedded in long-term memory.
Mm-hmm.
The cool thing about that is it appears to be free to working memory. In other words, anything that you've already mastered at that level of depth it's just a pattern that appears and you suddenly like chess masters, you know, looking at a chessboard,
yeah.
the queen is at risk. It's like, I just see that.
Interesting, bro. You're making me think of the expression, you know, he's renting space in your head. It's actually they're renting space in your
working
memory, right? Because if it was long-term memory, you're like, come on, plenty of room over there. Hang in all you like. Yeah.
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. And so a key thing there then is, okay, so if we were on our best behavior around doing training, we should be asking, okay, what is in long-term memory and what is not in long-term memory? Because, for example, unlike driving, where you really can't plan a summer vacation while driving to work or to a Starbucks, you cannot really write a persuasive essay and at the same time plan your summer vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Writing a persuasive essay is a collaboration between working memory, doing sophisticated analysis of the audience and the language and the evidence, the points I'm making, and a bunch of automated stuff around what is standard language? How do I do this punctuation thing? How do I spell things and so forth? So a lot of expert stuff is a trained collaboration between working memory, but then it draws crucially on stuff in long-term memory so that working memory is only working on the things that it needs to work on. And this is where that 10,000 hours thing comes in. This is work by Anders Ericsson and others who have looked to say, well, how do you get stuff into long-term memory? And these are these ideas of deliberate practice.
Yeah.
Where you have to really think about what you're doing, get feedback, do it again, trying to accommodate the feedback more.
And that this was another one, just to jump into, this is another one where it's frequently misunderstood as just doing something for 10,000 hours, because you need to be consciously paying attention. The feedback piece is really important. In some ways, you need to be trying to understand, how do I do this best? How do I actually become an expert? And then actually like go through that feedback exercise, reflecting on what you're doing as you're trying to get better to that ideal.
Yeah. There's actually a great book by Joth Colvin, Colvin, called Talent is Overrated.
Mm.
And it walks through a number of these kinds of examples. I think this is right. I think it's either in there or else it's in Malcolm Gladwell's Outlier.
Right.
They talk about, you know, people like Ben Franklin, who wanted to become a better writer, and other experts. And part of what these top performers do for deliberate practice is they look at other experts and they try to figure out, what is the difference in a small thing that I'm trying to do between how I do it and how somebody who's better than I am does it?
Yeah.
And then you then create dedicated training to shrink the gap between how I'm doing it and how a top performer does it.
Yeah.
And then you do practice and feedback cycles to actually kind of, in your own mind, at least measurably bring these things together. So it's very deliberate, as you said. It's not just hours on a golf course. Yeah. It's actually quite deliberate coaching and feedback and practice and all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so roughly, and you know, it's plus minus, but Anders Ericsson did some work on musicians and there's been some other people too. Kind of 10,000 hours plus or minus is enough to lift you from your starting levels to really good competence, kind of world-class competence. Now, there's something else about becoming the top performer, right. But just becoming really good at something, that's where that 10,000 hours thing comes in, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you think about 10,000 hours, that is about a decade of halftime performance, because, mm-hmm. you know, full-time year work is like 2,000 hours or something like that.
Right, right.
So, and deliberate practice, one, it's exhausting. And two, you probably have to pay your mortgage.
Right. You're filling out expense reports. You're surfing on the internet a little bit. I mean, we're humans. Yeah.
And so at most, you can kind of push yourself maybe to do halftime deliberate practice. And what's interesting is when you look at a lot of careers and you look at the career trajectories, 10 years to get through medical school, to get through your internship, residency, fellowship training, and now you become an expert physician. Mm-hmm. 10 years, law school, and then you get into the associate track, and then you become, et cetera, and then you become, right? 10 years from getting into the School of Architecture to then doing some internship and then, you know, getting trained and then becoming a fully fledged architect.
Yeah.
There's actually lots of careers that have sort of a 10-year envelope around them. Mm-hmm. And that sort of are consistent with this idea of, it takes a lot of practice and feedback to actually get that. And so what's interesting here is then when you think about this world of work, you know, we're going to need to do more than one cycle of getting to be good at things, right? Mm-hmm. If you only do one and then down your tools and stop, you can be world-class for a bit. But if the nature of expertise changes and that you need new tools and new approaches,
right,
you kind of have to be ready to do it again. Mm-hmm. And that's for you as an individual. The interesting other side of it is for organizations too, that, you know, for a long time, you know, you could just hire people who were trained to be experts and they would be experts and you'd get value from it. Woo-hoo! And off you'd go and you'd run your business.
Yeah.
Over the last 10 or 20 years, a number of different ecosystems and industries have found that the half-life of skills is getting shorter than a full career.
Yeah.
And the most, I don't know what you want to say, but the most mean-spirited kind of commercial entities then kind of have a fire and hire mentality, which is, well, we fire the old guys.
Yeah.
We just hire the new guys who are coming out of training. Mm-hmm. And we've handled the problem, right? Mm-hmm. Because we just let go all these old farts who,
Who are paid more too. I mean, let's be real.
All that. And so, you know, woo-hoo, right?
Yeah.
What's interesting is as the half-life of skills keeps getting shorter and shorter, that's not going to work anymore because it does take a few years for somebody coming in to learn the ropes.
Right.
How does this business work? What are our markets? Who are the big customers? How are decisions made? What are we trying to do over the future? Right. So, if you get to a stage where I got to fire everybody after a year,
right,
you really are not going to have a very effective business. So what this means is even from a cold, you know, green eye shade accounting standpoint, there's real value in becoming actually very good at changing the skills of people in my organization, because then they maintain their understanding of the business, the history, the clients, the way we think about things around here, the culture, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you can get really good at training people on what is the next set of skills, what is the next best performers doing, how are they all doing it?
Right.
Now you can continue to add value even as the nature of expertise changes as time goes on.
That's really interesting though, too, because that reminds me of, in addition to the skills gap, there's actually an experience gap that we're having now. And this is also why a lot of the blowback against the Gen Z workforce is that they really can't perform the tasks that we expect them to. They should be tech literate when, you know, implicit, just getting back to that tacit knowledge, implicit in being tech literate is knowing how to use Microsoft Office and understanding how to manage your calendar and, you know, write a coherent email. And like those things just become implicit to the knowledge worker who's, you know, 10 years in, they have their 10,000 hours. And, you know, it is interesting. I think we'll be surfacing more of this as we think more about artificial intelligence. It's forcing us, which is why I think the learning science angle that you're bringing to these conversations is like a mega trend that I see continuing to explode, really, because we're going to start wondering, well, how do we retool ourselves faster? I've likened it to Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers. Either us or the AIs are dancing backwards in heels, but either way, it's complicated and it requires some choreography.
It absolutely does. And I know there's actually interesting research going on around how that choreography is supposed to work. That is recognition that it can't all be on one side or the other.
Yeah.
There's actually some models being used where you look at, like in the military or police, how do humans and animals work together? Right. And that's, you know, and you have to train them together.
Yeah.
Learn to kind of trust each other and adapt to each other and all that. It is not all one-sided at all. And so there's some suggestion that maybe we got to figure out how to do that kind of co-training, even though we usually think of our tools as being things that are fixed and we have to adapt to them.
Right.
But now maybe there's an opportunity to do even better by kind of jointly doing this. So
it's
such a good point. So a key thing then is, you know, just being able to change your skills and add value that way. But there's another piece of this that I think is also really interesting, which is, okay, well, what's the point of having people around at all? I mean, if your AI starts to be more capable as a lawyer or as an accountant or even as a diagnostician in a medical circumstance, what is people's value add, right?
This does lead you, just for pop culture, this leads you to the WALL-E or the Idiocracy scenarios where the AIs take the interesting stuff away from us and we all just kind of goof off and drink smoothies all day.
That's exactly, in those giant mobile teleporting chairs, right? I want one of them, by the way.
It's coming. It's coming. I just looked at a breakdown of the Consumer Electronics Show. It's not that far away.
Yeah. I love that. One way to think about this, which is related to all of this cognitive science we just talked about, is something about combinations of skills is a bit unique. So you may have an AI that can render a tax opinion or render a business judgment or render a diagnostic thing better than humans can, and kind of instantly, as opposed to taking the 10 years.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is when you look at what humans really are still uniquely good at, often there's things like these creative clashes and constructs between and among different expertises. The example I sometimes like to use is, okay, imagine becoming a world-class gardener. Okay, so it takes you 10,000 hours, you put in your 10 years. Okay, fine. And then you start to think, you know, I really want to have a robotic team to continue the gardening expertise that I have started.
Yeah.
Okay, well, then you need maybe 10 years of becoming really good at robotics.
Right.
And again, if we have good learning environments, which we can come back to, what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. Well, okay, now I just need to half time, be deeply engaged in robotics work, and I become a world-class roboticist on top of my world-class gardening.
Yeah.
So that I can begin to figure out, how do I do this right and do this well?
Look out, Edward Scissorhands. Yeah.
And now, see, the thing is, I'm thinking, well, okay, I want to make a business out of this, right? I'm going to make a big business, a world-class robot gardening business.
Yeah.
Well, how do I get the business judgment? Well, I could take another 10 years and begin to add on. What does it mean to be a great business person in the modern era at the time I'm doing that, right? So now that's 10 more years of that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, if you start when you're 20 and you're living to be 90.
Right.
You've actually got like 7 decades worth of expertise to add, right?
Right.
So we got through our 3rd decade with the world-class business expertise on top of world-class robotics, world-class gardening. And maybe the final thing is, by the time I get to have a large, you know, world-class robot gardening business, I'm going to have injury lawsuits. I'm going to have issues, right? Those clippers wielded by the robot. So I guess maybe 10 years of law to help get my defenses in line, right? Ensure then that all clashes and connects and crosses over into what the robots do, into the business decision-making, and indeed the risks of gardening, right? So, so when you think about that, 4 different decades, 4 world-class competencies.
Right.
Now let's do the combinatorics, right?
Nice.
See, that's a great word to use in business.
You have me at combinatorics. Combinatorial I like too. Yeah, they're both good.
The notion of, well, how many of these kinds of mixes of expertise can you have? Well, you can pick your own numbers, but if you said there were 500 different kinds of expertise, let's use a simple one, 1,000. Maybe that's too many. Let's say there are 1,000 different kinds of expertise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you take 1,000 expertise and then pick one of those, and then out of the remaining basically 1,000, pick another one, and then another and another, you have 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000 different, unique combinations, which I think is a trillion if I did the numbers.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of zeros.
And there's only about 9-10 billion people.
Right.
So actually, there's plenty of such combo expertises to go around among the humans.
Right.
It's not as if, oh no, I'm competing against AI and 10,000 other tax accountants. It's like, no. You know, there may be nobody else who is turned into a world-class gardener, roboticist, business person, injury lawyer.
Right. Yeah, and I imagine even the sequencing probably would have an impact. That is also where, getting back to, you were touching on this before, like, are there ways to design better training environments, better learning environments? This is another one where, you know, VR sims and ways to kind of like get your reps in. You know, I listen to all my podcasts at least 2x, you know, so now it feels like we're talking very slowly. You know, there are ways in which the technology can accelerate some of the stuff to get to 10,000 hours. And then also, you know, I kind of learned about spaced repetition I learned it from you, bro. But like that kind of stuff, I imagine, can help tune these combinatorial humans to be performing even at a higher level, perhaps, than they could have in the past.
There's an interesting piece of research that recently came out that relates directly to that. And we might take a minute or two on this, because I think the results are both fascinating and really optimistic in the context of all the stuff we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it gets right at that issue you're saying, which is, hey, there may be efficiencies in how we can do this if we do our learning environments right. This is work from a guy named Ken Kadinger at Carnegie Mellon University, and his lab came out last year, almost exactly a year ago, actually. What they have there is they have a very large set of data called Data Shop that comes from lots of online tutoring modules, basically, that are called cognitive tutors. And they are, you know, many, many dozens of these. And they are in elementary school, middle school, high school. They are language arts, math, science, all kinds of different subjects.
They've been around for a while and they predate the LLMs. You know, just like, you know, you've helped me reacquaint myself with the long history of artificial intelligence, where like it's not really just, you know, the last couple of years, which also speaks to that deeper context you get when you understand a fuller through line. This is the other aspect of experience where you can make connections in ways that others wouldn't be able to.
Exactly. So the thing that Ken and his team said, it was a great thought, was to say, hey, we got all this data on learners and how they do. Let's go find the fast learners. Let's go find learners, especially those who start out kind of lower in their initial performance. Mm-hmm. And then let's find out who are the fast learners. We'll go study them and see if we can train people to be fast learners, right? We shorten from 10,000 hours, et cetera. So the first thing they did was to say, well, let's look at well-designed learning environments, so well-designed, you know, tutoring modules. And their definition of well-designed was quite specific. Data Shop lets you look at the learning curves. Mm. So it lets you look at how do learners improve their likelihood of getting something right based on a number of training experiences around that outcome they have. A well-designed module or well-designed piece, you have a standard learning curve where you learn more in the first few reps of doing it, and then you learn a little less and learn a little less, and you have this nicely sloping thing that you see. And so they said, let's focus on those courses where the developers have actually tuned their learning curves. So if you had some jagged looking horror story for one of the outcomes, they went in and they fixed it. They tried to do it again or split it up or whatever you need to do. It's actually quite cool that you can do this from the data. Yeah. It's not, does Brohr think it's a nice learning experience? It's like, no. Does the data show that it's well-designed? So they focused on well-designed learning experiences. And then they said, great, now let's go find the fast learners. So the first thing they found looking at their data was one they expected, which is, it is amazing in these modules, the variety of initial learning performances learners had. Some learners almost were ready to go from the very beginning, and so they just needed a couple of practice opportunities. Some learners, however, were pretty far down and needed a lot of learning opportunities to actually master what they were up to.
Yeah.
That they expected. But Michael, here's the crazy thing. What they did not expect is that in these well-designed learning opportunities, everybody's learning rate was the same. So what that's a slight technical point. What you can do is the learning curve is a curve, but you can apply a transformation to it called a log odds ratio. So using that, it looks like a straight line. So it becomes a straight line instead. And so what they were going to look for is who has the steepest line so that, you know, they're learning faster with every learning opportunity.
Yeah.
When they did that log odds ratio, they discovered everybody's line was parallel.
Huh.
Which means no matter where you started, your increment in log odds ratio terms for each well-designed practice opportunity you accomplished was the same. So there's a couple of things about this that are really remarkable. First of all, it flies in the face of our intuition. We think we know people who are faster learners.
Right.
Right. And so it's like, this can't be right. And I assure you, Ken's team was like, we've screwed up our statistics. We've blown this thing up. But they then ran simulated models and tried, and they discovered, no, it's the data that's telling us this, right? So how can that be? So my thinking about it is most learning environments are not well designed. So if you're in a badly designed learning environment, there's another skill, which is how do I now add the practice and feedback that I need? How do I augment this awful learning environment?
Yes.
Gets me where I want to go. Others will just do what they're asked. And so if I have my own instructional design that works well, I will then show up as a faster learner. Right? But these were well-designed learning environments. So they'd already had all of that
accounted for.
Squeezed out. Right?
Yeah.
So it was already accounted for. Right? So this is one thing, the importance of well-designed learning environment. The second thing, which is fascinating, is now think how important motivation has become.
Yeah.
Because motivation is about starting, persisting, putting in mental effort, right? And what this showed is that if you are starting low, you absolutely needed to have more practice opportunities, more shots on goal.
Yeah.
Every one of those was giving you the same benefit as somebody who started out in the middle.
Yeah.
You really had to do those. You know, you might have to do a dozen shots on goal, dozen learning opportunities to get to the same level as a more median person who only needs like five or six to get to the same level.
Yeah.
It's there for you, right?
Right.
And in fact, if you stop early, you literally can predict how much you're not going to get to, right? So motivation suddenly becomes essential because that is not what students or faculty or teachers or even parents, this is not what people think.
Right.
Like people think, oh, you know, math is awfully hard for you. You know,
right.
Else for you because that's always going to be slow for you.
Right, right.
It's like, this is not true.
Mm-hmm.
You are moving up at the same rate as everybody else.
Right.
You just need more reps to kind of get.
So you need motivation to do more reps, and then the learning environments have to be well designed. So like there's a lot in
third,
that.
Third, and this is why this is so interesting, is a structural element, right? When you think about kids who are in college or kids who are growing up in difficult, marginalized circumstances, who's got the time to take enough shots on goal? In university, you show up, you're not doing so well, let's say, but you have a heavy work-study requirement. So you work 50 hours a week.
Yeah.
And the professor says, you got to get through this module in a week. Okay. A kid with nothing else to do can get their dozen shots on goal and dozen learning opportunities and has moved now up to where they need to be.
Right.
The kid with 50 hours of work study literally doesn't have the time.
Yeah.
So there's a structural part of this too, which says not only do kids and faculty and others need to have the motivation to do this, we got to give them the space and time to actually get there.
Lots of equity implications on that last point there.
Lots.
Right?
Lots. And the paper is fun because it's one of the few peer-reviewed papers I've ever seen that uses the word astonishing in the title.
Wow.
An astonishing regularity of learning rates. Right?
Yeah.
And he has all these charts showing these parallel lines for these learning rates. It's just really amazing. But so to me, to our earlier conversation about what, you know, how does this work and what do we do and how do we keep up? What this says is, you know what? Our learning machinery, if it's exposed to well-designed learning opportunities, and you have enough learning opportunities, almost all of us are able to actually make progress to get to high levels of performance. And so I think that's a piece that, you know, is so important coming out of the data that we don't have to write people off.
Right.
We just need to give them enough space and time and well-designed learning environments, and they will actually change. What will be in long-term memory and their capacity and expertise will actually change, you know, quite dramatically.
Although there is implicit in that is the real motivation challenge, which I think increasingly is the job of the educator or the learning enterprise, is like, how do I reach that person who may be starting to check out? And that's why some of the robot overlord narrative and the idea that, you know, we're being shook as humans, where the AIs are taking what we think is unique to us, it's forcing us to seek out learning science. And then the other piece I wanted to hit on, you were talking a little bit before about meaning and shared meaning.
So I'd
love to hear a little more about that.
Sure. So another, if you think of one wing of how people can be highly valuable as being a bunch of competencies crashing together in your head to allow you to be creative and new and all that. So that's kind of one wing of how people can continue to have value compared to just the one-shot single expertise AI, right?
Yeah.
Another thing, and I heard this was an expression from a venture capitalist who was asked at a conference I was at, what is the point of including, you know, people in the workforce given that AI seemed to do everything better? So he didn't go down that wing of multiple competences, but what he went down was a completely different wing that I think is so valuable. He said, well, one of the things that people are uniquely good at doing is giving meaning to each other's activities, right? So you're giving meaning to your struggles, giving meaning to your efforts. That, you know, it's one thing in a community theater if the audience chairs are all filled with robots who then leap to their feet at the end of your amateur performance of Hamlet and applaud wildly.
Yeah. Okay.
Really? I mean,
it's good concept. It's good concept art.
Another thing entirely, if it's your neighbors and friends who leap to their feet and have tears in their eyes and applaud wildly.
Yeah.
That gives me meaning. Right. So people can give each other meaning. Same thing, you know, humans have these lives, right? Where there's lots of stages and issues that we all end up trying to decide. And, you know, go back to philosophy over 5,000 years, right? It's like aging.
Yeah.
Those kids today.
Yeah. I was
Aristotle who was doing that. You know,
I was thinking Eric Erickson too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so we have these stages and aging, obviously. And how does the end of life come? All of that. And so we have these very human things that are happening to us.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, you know, having an AI say, I feel your pain. Yeah. AI, not so much. But another person who then has their own lived experience.
Yeah.
Loss or challenge or aging or parenting or whatever it is. That's a meaningful, in a literal sense, it's a meaningful conversation that somebody can give me.
Yeah.
And then similarly, and people talked about this for a while, you know, when you think about in businesses, even things like selling, right? It's one thing to just simply have a catalog. What do you want? You know, I'm eating my lunch. What do you want? And it's another thing to actually be trying to understand what is your problem?
Yeah.
What are you trying to get done, right? It's solution selling.
Mm-hmm.
Which is highly valuable as a way of then bringing what we have to add value to you, right?
Yeah.
And so the notion of I am giving you meaning, I'm giving your problems meaning, and all kinds of other stuff, like managing people and all kinds of things.
Right.
In a way, many of those things are all tied in around this idea of becoming good at giving meaning to each other.
Yeah.
Honestly, if you think about our usual school systems and all that, aside maybe from a few things like Montessori or Waldorf or whatever, we so underskill our kids in listening to each other and learning about the lived experiences of other people, other kids, even in my own little class.
Yeah.
That, you know, to then build up expectations that I'm not going to know you when the first time I meet you. I have to get to know you as opposed to, well, you're a human, I'm a human. Of course you think like I do, right?
Right.
And so then it becomes incredibly valuable in a diverse, multi-person workforce where study after study shows better solutions to complex problems come from teams that are diverse, not monoculture teams, but teams that are diverse. But you kind of have to know how to listen to each other and work with each other a bit.
Yeah.
We need to do more early on to help give kids those valuable skills that honestly will last for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Because our life stages, things that give us meaning, that hasn't changed in tens of thousands of years, and it's not going to change in the future. So those skills become also really important as being high value.
Yeah. It reminds me of talking about serve and return and the way in which you sort of, by paying attention to what your kid's doing and responding to it, you're actually building their brains to some extent and their mental models, their ways of understanding the world. That's our wiring. And it's easy to forget that. The interesting question, and I know we're going to have a third installment of this where we might get more into the artificial intelligence side and emerging technology side of the equation. But to me, the interesting question is, can the technology in some ways enhance our ability to have more meaningful engagements, either by being brilliant matchmakers or teeing up the right conversation pieces or being in these amazing virtual reality experiences? But we are entering into a new era, I think, in terms of what this technology may unlock. And I'm just really excited to be getting your expertise to bring to bear on this, particularly the learning implications, and then how that kind of relates to everything that's going on. We clearly can go on and on. We will continue. But any concluding thoughts as we're wrapping up here, Burr?
No, I think it's a little bit like, I think, the last time too, that one of the things that I really like about the learning sciences, including cognitive science, motivational science, behavioral economics, and so forth, is just like this Ken Kadinger work that I described, man, it has such an optimistic message for what can happen, what our potentials are. And it's so easy to get down on human beings or even ourselves as individuals. But in fact, the machinery is available to do extraordinary new things over time if we can just give ourselves those conditions. So to me, there's just a ton of optimism to be had from all of that. And that's part of why it's fun, I think, to talk about this with you, too. It's just
fun. Exactly. The robot podcast hosts have not replaced me yet so far. keeping it together as best I can. Burr, always amazing to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for asking.
And we'll include more information about Burr and what he's doing at Learning Forge in the show notes for the episode. Thanks to our listeners, as always, for listening. We'd love your feedback. Let us know what you think about this type of conversation. You want us to go in new directions. We're going to continue it down the line. Please subscribe, tell your friends, do all the good things. We'll be back again soon. This is Trending in Education.